Welcome to This Week in Money. I'm Jim Goddard. Today, Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com runs down the major markets and how they reacted to the Fed's 0.25% rate hike. The NASDAQ seems to have liked it, but the other markets, especially the Russell 2000, did not. Author of The Dollar Collapse, John Rubino, feels the Fed's actions have not done the banking sector any favors and that the entire global financial system may be nothing more than a giant Ponzi scheme. The Trendletter.com's Martin Straith weighs in on banking failures, shaky government finances, and how you might protect your finances. He also has a special offer for our listeners. Plus, at the end of the show, we'll have a company showcase update from Recyclico CEO Zarko Maselgia. We'll talk to Ross Clark right after this.
Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit Recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
Welcome to This Week in Money, the source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com, where you'll find insightful market commentary and timely technical analysis. You can find him on Twitter at ChartsByRoss. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Always good to be with you, Jim.
Ross, what kind of a reaction did the markets have to the Fed hiking rates by 0.25%?
Well, the 0.25 was not a big number. You know, this was the anticipation. And, you know, the question was, the economic numbers and the SVB bank issues in the last 10 days had people wondering just what the Fed would end up doing. Would they hold it nothing? Would they do a little bit, which is what they did? Clearly, they couldn't go to a half a point at this point. Now. So, you know, a lot of chattering since the Wednesday announcement. But, you know, the bottom line is that we've really got different sectors on the move here in different directions. You get things like the Russell 2000 ended up during the week. That was a new low for the week or for the month and for the year. And on the other side of the, or sort of the middle of the range, you know, you got the Dow and the S&P trading mid-range for the last 6 months. And at the top end of the whole move is the NASDAQ, which the NDX closing up near the best levels of the year, the best levels back to September. So a nice looking base in there. And, you know, if we take a look at a couple of the names that are out there individually, things like Meta, Meta Platforms got a nice capitulation buy signal and weekly signal back in November when it was around $90. Had a great run, paused a little bit at 200, came back and, you know, had a nice pullback into 170. And here we are closing off this week at 206. Haven't seen numbers like this in almost a year. So an item there that's saying that's doing well. Apple has been just a great stock here in terms of the type of action. Nice signals at the end of the year. Bicycles in there, and a pause during to 145, closed off the week this week at the best levels that we've seen once again since September, just like Meta, leading on the upside. So we're at 160 on Apple, up from 100.25. So clearly, while they're broad markets, people would look at are really just not doing much, shattering day by day. There are individual stocks that are presenting some pretty good moves in here.
What's going on with crude?
Crude oil, we've been looking, once it broke the 72 level, and $72 has been a pretty good support, tested three times, and once it managed to break through there, that fit into our 10-year cycle model. The worst case in target was to be around 61. We did get to 64.5 this the beginning of this week, and the hourly charts just produced some very big oversold signals on the crude and the ETF, USO ETF on the crude oil. So we got a nice bounce, and the oil has made it back just shy of $72. So that ice level that had been our good support, once we cracked through there, it's natural to come back and do a retest, you know, which is what we saw on late Wednesday and Thursday. If it can manage to get through there, that would be a pretty good indication for a bottom. Now, this month of March really does set up for some potential here. It's been 9 months now of where we've had closes below 4 months earlier. Anytime we get that type of action on a, whether it's a daily, weekly, or monthly chart, you can look for the reversal to have the 2 to 5 bar movement in the opposite direction. So in this case, crude oil, all it has to do is close below $85, and it'll have that signal. So with us trading around 69.5 right now, unless it just picks off on the upside in the next 10 days, then we're going to have this buy signal on the sequential. And if we look back on it, there's only been half enough signals since the 1980s. They all have produced reasonable responses on the upside. So starting in the next couple of weeks here, if we get a retest to the lows or if it looks at the bottom, which is a retest for a break 270, I think you'll want to make sure to do that on the long side. Clearly some of the oil stocks have been hit pretty hard in the last month, and it's going to be good opportunities to pick up some of those stocks.
What's going on with the U.S. and Canadian dollars?
U.S. dollar, initially, you know, we were looking at the rally from that 101 to 10, just shy of 106, would hold on a 50% correction. Well, it's done more than that. We got down to 102 as of Thursday, Friday, and if anything, it looks as though we're probably just in a consolidation phase now. You know, maybe it's stuck in this broad trading range. Pretty big if it's to be from 102 to call it 106. Nothing that I would call in terms of definitive direction in there. On the Canadian dollar, it had been weak during February. You know, we take a look at it basis the other commodities, or basis the commodity sectors, the CRD index. We take a look at the grains, and in particular at the oil market. And the action in terms of movement with oil is really the strongest one out there. During February, the Canadian dollar underperformed the oil market. It started to ease up much more than the oil did. However, during March, it has really been in right in the lockstep with the oil. Every day or second day, you know, these things are moving together. So with it trading around 72.75 right now, if the oil market bottoms out, then we're definitely going to be looking for some upside action as far as the Canadian is concerned. A little premature to be bullish on it right now, but this has been a retest of the October lows, and if oil can turn, Canadian dollar probably gets some legs in here, and that will end up being a viable trade.
Anything happening with gold and silver?
Yes. This is one that has done exceptionally well in the last couple of weeks here. Having broken out through the January highs, it's been a nice run. The cash price has gone from 1810 to just over 2000, for the last 5 or 6 days here, has just pushed its head against that 2000 level, but unable to get through it. at this point, clearly trend is up. There's a big, what we would call a cup and handle pattern going all the way back for the last 4 or 5 years. If it can manage to break out of that one, we've got upside targets here that measure to 3,300. But right now, we're getting, we clearly become overbought. It's got to go through the consolidation. As long as it holds above 19.25 to 19.40, I would say trend is still up. Pullbacks, they'll have to hold at that level to stay, keep this market bullish. Pause here and we're seeing the same signals in silver in terms of the overbought, also the GDX, the GDXJ, so those are the three mining indices. Those are showing the miner excess is on the upside. So, time for patience. As we've been saying, you want to buy these gold miners on good, healthy corrections. You don't want to chase them at this point. So, if we get a correction, then definitely look to put a few dollars into that sector.
Ross, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Always a pleasure, Jim.
My guest has been Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com. Find him on Twitter at ChartsByRoss. Coming up, John Rubino, next on This Week in Money.
Always consult your investment professional before making any investment decision. Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com. This Week in Money is archived online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is John Rubino, author of several books on the economy, including The Money Bubble. He founded the website DollarCollapse.com. He's speaking to us from Washington State near Port Angeles. Beautiful area to visit. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Hey, Jim.
John, did the Fed just break the U.S. banking system?
It maybe just did. You know, so many people have been saying that the Fed was going to tighten until they broke something. But it turns out they may have already broken something with the tightening they've done so far. You know, the regional and local banking sector basically operates on what used to be the old banking model of borrowing short by taking in deposits and lending longer term by giving people business loans and mortgages and things like that. Well, that requires a positive sloping yield curve. In other words, long-term interest rates have to be higher than short. Well, we've made an inverted yield curve with the Fed tightening the way it has. And it's breaking the small banks of the country. And now the government is trying to decide whether to just bail out the banks as they blow up or to offer deposit insurance on basically everything in every bank. And, neither one of those ideas is good. The way you avoid bank bailouts is to not put the banking system in a place in the first place where you need to bail the banks out. And then if banks do get in trouble, it's capitalism. You need to let them fail. And you need to let the people who trusted those banks beyond the level of deposit insurance to suffer the consequences. And that's how the system works well. Failures teach us what not to do. But we're in a place where we're so financially fragile because we borrowed so much money that we can't allow anybody to fail. And so now you've got this completely incompetent government in the U.S. Oh, Janet Yellen, oh my God. Look up the video where there's a congressman asking her if all the banks in his state are covered by unlimited deposit insurance, and see what she says. She literally does not understand how the banking system works or what it is the government is doing to bail out the banks. It's terrifying. So anyhow, yeah, it's completely possible that a big part of the banking system is broken, and maybe quite a bit more. You know, there are big European banks that are also on the verge of going. So it's a question of who's next right now, and it could be virtually anybody out there.
Is this the end of tight money?
Yeah, I think it kind of is, even though a lot of central banks are still intending to raise interest rates from here. But I think what happened with the U.S. banking system and with Credit Suisse, a big Swiss bank blowing up, and Deutsche Bank, a big German bank blowing up, I think raising interest rates as far as we've raised them is leading to a lot of trouble already in the global financial system. And even if we just kept rates where they are right now, monetary conditions would continue to tighten as all the short-term debt that was taken on at lower interest rates rolls over at higher interest rates. So I think it's possible that we're done with this tightening cycle, and that the fact that it ended the way it's ending implies that we can never tighten again. And when people figure that out, then, you know, all hell is going to break loose in the monetary system. And, that's the kind of thing that's been, inevitable for a really long time. And now it might have shifted from inevitable to imminent. And that's going to make the next couple of years very interesting.
Is a recession still likely, even if central banks stop tightening?
Yeah, because part of it is what I said already, that interest rates are going to rise for all the short-term debt that's been taken on that has to be rolled over. And that's going to impact companies that borrowed incredible amounts of money in order to buy their stock back. You know, now their stock is lower, so they basically wasted all that money, but they still got to pay off the debt or roll it over. And when they roll it over at a higher rate, that increases their interest costs, which lowers their cash flow and their earnings, which hurts their stock price, and so on. But I think the big damage is going to be with governments, because the governments of the world, and I'm talking the U.S. and Japan mainly here, borrowed absolutely astronomical amounts of money, a lot of it at the short end of their yield curve. So they've got a lot to roll over. And a lot of, for instance, in the U.S., basically 0% debt is going to roll over at 4%, which means the interest cost on the U.S. government's debt is going to skyrocket, which they will borrow to cover, which means their debt is going to go up, which means their interest costs will go up even further. And they kind of step into a debt spiral when that happens. Japan is in even worse shape, much worse shape, because their government, on a per capita basis, borrowed more money than basically any other country in the history of the human race. And they borrowed it at lower interest rates. So now their rates are going up, and their interest costs are going up commensurately and potentially exponentially. So Japan might be the first government that does a Credit Suisse and just becomes insolvent. We'll have to see. But if the world's central banks stop raising interest rates right here, we would still have that effect happen over the next couple of years. So I see no alternative but for the Fed to start cutting interest rates pretty shortly here.
Is de-dollarization a real trend? And if so, what does it mean for the current global financial system?
You know, that's something that's been talked about for quite a while, but this year it became very real. Here's a few examples. The BRICS countries, which is Brazil, Russia, India, and China, along with some other countries, have decided to start a separate monetary union to avoid dependence on the dollar and the U.S. empire. And, so far so good. Lots of other countries want to join, including Saudi Arabia, interestingly. And if you look at what China, India, and Russia, and Saudi Arabia have, well, and add Brazil in there too, because Brazil is an agricultural powerhouse, and they've got a lot of raw materials. Well, Russia has an immense amount of oil and natural gas. China has a massive manufacturing base. India has more people than China right now, and they've got a pretty vibrant tech sector. And of course, Saudi Arabia is the oil export powerhouse of the world. So you put those guys together, and they've got a lot of advantages. If they want to form a monetary union, it looks like they're serious about doing it. Meanwhile, China just brokered a peace deal between Saudi Arabia and Iran, its bitter enemy. And there's a lot of speculation that that had to happen so they could both join the BRICS monetary union, because you can't have bitter enemies in the same monetary union. That would just cause chaos. So they had to make peace before they could both join, And lo and behold, they are apparently making peace right now under the auspices of China. So all of a sudden, it's completely possible that lots of other countries can do bilateral trade deals where they use each use the other's currency, or they use their own currency or whatever to buy oil and food and manufactured goods. And it's also possible, because China and Russia and India have been accumulating so much gold and silver, they could, in theory, back their new currency with gold, which would make it a legitimate competitor in a lot of international uses to the dollar. And meanwhile, Saudi Arabia and Iran have actually made peace, which is a shocking thing, because they've been lifelong enemies. You know, they're two different branches of Islam. They've never gotten along. They've fought wars in the past. They continue to have kind of a cold war going, but, China just brokered a peace between the two. And the theory is that, they couldn't both have joined the BRICS coalition if they were bitter enemies, because that would just cause chaos. So they had to be on at least neutral terms with each other. And China just helped them cut a deal that will apparently allow them both to join the BRICS Monetary Union. So it's completely possible that in the year ahead, a lot of countries are going to be able to do bilateral trade deals with each other in their own currencies and just bypass the dollar. That's something that has been speculated about for years, and this year it finally happened.
Now, a friend of the show, Tim Wood, pointed out when I interviewed him today that the M2, which measures how much available cash people have on hand, savings accounts, checking accounts, short-term instruments, that supply has been shrinking since November, and he says, which means the inflation we're suffering from right now isn't an oversupply of money, where high interest rates would help, but he said it's a supply chain problem. You still can't get auto parts on time. People are still waiting for their cars and trucks to be delivered, and then when they do get delivered, there's super high prices on them. So he said hiking interest rates actually is making inflation worse. Would you agree with that?
I definitely think the supply chain issues that stemmed from the U.S.-China trade war and the pandemic lockdowns and all the related stuff, they're playing a big part in the fact that there are a lot of shortages out there, and therefore prices are higher. Rising interest rates... They are a deflationary force, generally, because, other things being equal, it'll slow down economic growth. But I think the supply chain disruptions are, right now, a bigger force in the world. And I think the fact that the M2 money supply has been shrinking for the last almost year now is something that they should have been paying a lot closer attention to, because it never shrinks. I mean, if you run that chart back as far as you want to, and it's almost always gone up, even in bad years, even in recession, it's gone up. But lately, it started to roll over. And if you think of the global economy as one big Ponzi scheme, one of the characteristics of a Ponzi scheme is that it has to have an increasing supply of new cash coming in order to continue to function. Well, if you slow the amount of cash that's coming in, or actually start pulling cash out of the system, it breaks. And I think that's a lot of what we're seeing now. We're seeing, broken supply chains, and also the onshoring trend, where countries are bringing manufacturing back to at least their neighborhood, if not within their own borders, which is extremely expensive and inflationary, and leads to higher costs in almost everything. You combine all that, and you get a system that is on the verge of breaking, and I think that's what we've got right now. So whether inflation stays high or whether we drop into a deflationary slowdown, I don't think it really matters. I think the system as it's now configured, or as it was configured 2 years ago, is irreparable. And we've got to go through a process of setting something up that's brand new and that works. And that's going to be just just plain ugly. We've got to completely change the way global manufacturing works, and we've got to do some kind of monetary reset where currencies go back to something sustainable. And that's the idea that that's going to be a smooth process is really, really over-optimistic. I think it's going to be incredibly chaotic. And we're heading into that now. As you said, we've got broken supply chains and a shrinking money supply, and inflation and geopolitical chaos. And you add it all up, and there's really no way we get through this pain-free and chaos-free. So for the next few years, fascinating times.
Gold and silver seem to like what's happening right now, but should they?
In general, long term, they absolutely should, because the end game here is a monetary reset. As you mentioned, we've got rising inflation and a slowing economy due to a decreasing money supply, and that's bad for stock prices. It's bad for corporate earnings, which in turn is bad for stock prices. So we could easily see the final leg of the bear market in equities that started last year really hit pretty soon. And that would be one of those things that sucks gold and silver down with them. So I'm a little bit worried about a replay of 2008 or 2020. And that makes me a little bit nervous about jumping with both feet into precious metals, which I totally would do otherwise. But what we need to see first is that financial crisis that leads the central banks of the world to go back to aggressive easing. And we got halfway there now and scared enough to completely stop raising interest rates. And then they need to be even more scared so that they start cutting. When that happens, gold is over to the moon. And it's just a question of timing. We could ease in now and hope that we're deeply enough into gold and silver when it happens that we're ready, or we can just wait. I suggest dollar cost averaging, as always, with gold and silver. Just if you intend to buy some, make it the same dollar amount each month and let it build up. And then you don't have to worry about what prices are doing in the short run. If they go up, you're buying fewer ounces each month. And if they go down, you're buying more ounces. Your average cost will count. So do that instead of trying to time this market, because it's too chaotic for anybody to time effectively.
Is this a good time to be adding to mining stock portfolios?
Well, again, maybe. Some of the miners, especially some of the junior miners, are reporting excellent drill results. And if you've got somebody like that, yes, their stock can go down, but their operations are doing so well that the next big bonanza drill result could offset an overall weaker stock market. So same thing here, I think. Dollar cost average into the highest quality mining stocks. In other words, the royalty streaming companies at the top end and the very best producers in the mid-range, and then the juniors with the best drill results and the most rock-solid finances. And over time, you'll build up a portfolio that's at a good average price and that's positioned to just take off when things really get going. So I own a lot of the mining stocks, and I'm continuing to buy more, but just the highest quality. No risk-taking involved other than with the juniors, and even there, it's the ones with the very best fundamentals across the board. So don't take risks. Don't buy things that are that your brother-in-law tells you about because he heard from the guy who cuts his hair. Don't do that. Look into these things very deeply. Make sure their fundamentals are just perfect, and then nibble. Do not jump with both feet, but dollar cost average into these things over time.
Now, the Wall Street Journal published an article saying that if we're going to mitigate so-called climate change, it's going to cost $130 trillion. Well, is that amount even possible? And should we just, if climate is changing, start building up seawalls and evacuate people from places that are definitely going to flood?
Yeah, you know, the extreme end of the climate change alarmist segment of the population, they're just running some kind of a scam, and I'm not even completely sure what the scam is. It looks, originally it looked like a way of funneling money into the green segments of the economy. Now it looks like a way of gaining control. There's going to be some kind of a climate emergency, and they're going to use that as an excuse for martial law, et cetera, et cetera. Because there's no way that the extreme predictions and the proposed solutions to those extreme predictions make any sense. If we tried to go 100% electric car, for instance, or if we were going to just replace gas and natural gas and oil with solar panels, you know, solar panels are great. They're going to be a very big part of the future energy system. And they've got a lot of advantages today, but there is absolutely no way you can replace all of existing the energy infrastructure with just solar panels. It just can't work for a lot of different reasons. And at the same time, the guys who are most terrified about climate are also opposed to nuclear, which has its disadvantages, but is a form of power that doesn't put any carbon into the air. So you would think that if it was about an imbalance in carbon in the atmosphere and the long-term effects of that, that the people who actually care about that would be very happy to make the trade-off between nuclear's, for instance, its waste disposal problems, and the fact that it's a zero-carbon energy source. But they're not, you know, and until the Greens buy into nuclear, they can't be trusted because their motivations have to be suspect because their behavior is so bizarre. So that's my take on the climate situation. And I think there are parts of environmental degradation that are very serious, like the plastic thing. You know, if we've got whales dying because they're ingesting too much plastic, and every person on Earth is inhaling a credit card size amount of plastic every day, that is a disastrously dangerous thing, and we should be doing everything we can to fix it. But the climate thing, the temperature difference, no, that's not big enough for the kind of solutions that are being proposed.
Well, also, too, we know from drilling glacier cores that the Earth has natural cycles, about 110,000 years of ice and 10,000 years of warm. We're right in the middle of the warm period. We should be glad.
Yeah, I think you could make a compelling case that if we can indeed do something to warm up the Earth, we should absolutely be doing it to stave off the next ice age. Because you want to talk about economic losses and mass extinctions, try covering half the world with ice and see how many species die and how many cities just disappear under the ice and how many countries go bankrupt. That would be vastly more expensive than a 3% or a 3-degree increase in global temperatures and a 1 or 2 meter increase in sea levels. There's no comparison between the cost of those two things. So, yeah, I haven't completely figured out what the scam is exactly, but I'm watching the climate thing and trying to figure out what it is exactly they're going for, because they don't have good data, and their proposed solutions to the implications of their bad data are just so bizarre and so completely non-feasible that there has to be something else going on. So let's revisit this. And if I figure out a coherent scenario, but I can tell you I will.
Well, I've always wondered how carbon taxes, which are super high in Canada, are going to stop volcanic eruptions, changes in the Earth's orbit, or solar activity, the major drivers of climate change.
Yes. the natural cycles. Yeah, you look at any map of temperatures and carbon dioxide in the air, going back to, the days of the dinosaurs, and it's been much hotter than it is now and much colder than it is now. And lately, even, it's been much hotter and much colder than it is now. So the Earth does things that are completely independent of human activity. Maybe we have some impact, but Nothing compared to, like you said, volcanoes and changes in solar radiation. And furthermore, if the U.S. at least actually cared about the amount of carbon that we're putting in the atmosphere, they wouldn't have blown up the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, because blowing up that natural gas pipeline put more natural gas in the atmosphere than we've saved by all the cuts that we've done over the last 5 years. So we completely negated all of our climate efforts over the last half decade by doing this one stupid geopolitical act. And if we really cared, we wouldn't have done it.
John, anything else we should be keeping a close eye on right now?
Let me see. Well, watch Deutsche Bank. That's the next big bank that people seem to be worrying about. Their credit default swaps are going through the roof, which means it's getting more and more expensive to insure against defaults on Deutsche Bank debt. And because the whole world's looking around after Credit Suisse and after the U.S. banking crisis, they're looking around for who's next. And in a fractional reserve banking world, you can't survive if you're the bank that everybody decides is next. So it could be that Deutsche Bank blows up on us in the coming, and you know how fast these things are happening now. They'll be fine one day and extinct a week later. It could be that next time you and I talk, Deutsche Bank doesn't exist anymore. And if that's the case, then the who's next and what's next spotlight is going to be much broader. They'll be looking at a lot of different things, and a lot of different things will be tanking as a result. So we could be at the very beginning stages of a major global crisis that we don't even feel like is happening right now. It feels like the U.S. has bailed everybody out and we're okay, and Credit Suisse was a one-off thing. It could be that that's not the case. So next month when you and I talk, it's completely possible we'll have this gigantic story to tell. The European and U.S. and maybe Japanese banking systems all dropping off of a cliff at the same time.
John, always fascinating to chat with you.
Thanks, Jim.
And thanks a lot for being on This Week in Money. My guest has been John Rubino, author of several books on the economy, including The Money Bubble. Coming up, Martin Strath next on This Week in Money.
Recyclico, making lithium-ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Martin Strath, founder of Trend News Online at thetrendletter.com. He's speaking to us from Coquitlam, BC, which is just east of Vancouver. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Thanks, Jim. Good to be here.
Can you tell us a bit about the Trend News, the letters you publish, how people can sign up for it, and do you have a special offer for our listeners?
I can. So, we have three publications. The Trend Letter, so started back in 2002. So what's that? That's our 21st year now. Publishes every Sunday evening, covers equities, currencies, precious metals, commodities, and bonds. Each issue is about 50 pages, but it's mostly charts with key bullet points, makes it easy to read. So it's like a 10-minute read. Focus audience, people, long-term investors who want to understand what's driving the markets. Our second one is Trend Technical Trader. So online service started as a hedging service, which has been really, really useful for the recent bear market. But it also invests in long positions, covers many sectors, commodities, equities, precious metals, and it includes our proprietary gold technical indicator. Focus audience here would be more active investors, but again, you know, long-term investors have obviously benefited really well from those hedging strategies. And our third one is Trend Disruptors. invest in disruptive ideas, artificial intelligence, virtual reality, you know, 5G, cloud, Internet of Things. So very speculative sector, and the audience here, people wishing to speculate, but only with risk capital they can afford to lose. Yeah, we do have some specials. You can go to thetrendletter.com/special-offer. And what you can do there, depending on what you want, whether you wanted a single subscription or some packaged ones, you'll get between 40 and 65% off. So, yeah, and if you've got any questions, if anybody's got any questions, just info@thetrendletter.com.
We've seen a number of bank failures in the last couple of weeks. Are there more to come?
Well, Jim, pretty hard to imagine there won't be. You know, very interesting. On Wednesday, the Fed press release said that they had no mention of the bank failures, which I thought was quite interesting. In the last week's issue of the Trend Letter, we highlighted how the Fed Chair Powell and the Secretary, Treasury Secretary Yellen, they issued a joint statement on Sunday afternoon stating that there is not a liquidity problem. I mean, the very fact that they felt compelled to issue a statement on a Sunday, that tells us there is a liquidity problem. You know, when the central banks of Canada, the U.S., Japan, U.K., Europe, when they all jumped in and provided almost $1 trillion of liquidity to stop a global bank crisis, tells us there is a liquidity problem. You know, when you got the Swiss government had to step in and force UBS to take over Credit Suisse, you know, again, we've got a problem. You know, in order to get that takeover approved, the Swiss government changed laws, ignored bank bond rules just to push through that takeover. They actually gave shareholders $3.2 billion to ensure that the takeover went through, even though their laws state that shareholders are the lowest rung and that they are expected to take 100% of losses before bondholders lose a penny. But that's not what happened. They wrote off $17 billion of Credit Suisse AT1 bonds, even though the bondholders should have been paid ahead of the shareholders. So, you know, this tells us these problems are pretty big. These central bankers are running around, you know, they're plugging holes like crazy here. So what triggered the big run on Silicon Bank? Well, you know, for almost a decade, we've seen near zero rates in banks. So banks like Silicon Valley, they don't have to pay any, they didn't pay any money for customer deposit. And then they took that money and they invested in longer term government bonds. So say 10-year bond paying maybe up to, you know, half a percentage point. And then what they did is they gained on the spread. So they didn't have to pay anything to the depositor. And then they got a half a percent from the bond. So, you know, then in the last year, the Fed finally starts raising rates, and they started raising them pretty quick. They went, what, from 0.25% up to 5% within a year. So now these banks are sitting there holding these bonds that are only paying half a percent, while the current rate is, you know, 4.5%. So that would not be a problem if they were able to hold the bonds to maturity. But the problem was, is that the depositors decided they wanted to start moving the money out of the banks and putting it into, you know, better investments like just money markets. And that forced the bank to have to sell these bonds at a steep loss. I mean, if you're forced to sell a bond paying half a percent, while the current bonds are paying 4.5%, you're going to have to take a big cut. And that's what exactly happened to Silicon Valley. So since then, we've had the Fed, they've put in new facilities now to allow banks to basically get par for those bonds. But the real problem we've got now is that there's a collapse of confidence, and that's been causing the bank run on deposits. So in the States right now, deposits in U.S. banks are down 3% year over year, and that's unprecedented. People are withdrawing their savings. I mean, if that continues, banks are going to have to start selling assets to meet the demands of these depositors who want to move their money out of the banks. And, you know, people have to understand there is $18 trillion of deposits in U.S. banks. So this could get pretty ugly here. So maybe this time's different, But I think most people are starting to realize that every time these central banks act on something, there are always unintended consequences. I mean, it's almost like watching a whack-a-mole. You know, they see a problem here, and then they solve it, and then it pops, another one pops up over there. So I would really be surprised if we don't see another bank failure. I mean, it could be limited to a small U.S. bank, but I suspect we're going to see some more problems in Europe. You know, just today, Deutsche Bank's stock is getting whacked. That's on Friday. You know, their stock is down 30% in the last 2 months. You know, so I think we're going to see some more problems here. You know, negative rates in Europe, you have to remember in Europe, they actually had negative rates. And that severely hampered their banking system, and it's really damaged their bond market. So the big risk now is if we see more failures and we get contagion kicking in, then depositors are going to start looking around to ask who's next. And so I think we really need to watch out over the next 3 weeks or so, and we want to see if there's going to be another shoe to drop here. Now, for your listeners, you know, they need to make sure that they are aware of what the rules are in their country for regarding, you know, insured deposits. You know, one of our subscribers did a great job laying out how it works in Canada. You know, in Canada, deposits are insured for up to $100,000 per category. So that means your account type. So that could be your, you know, unregistered accounts, your registered accounts, your RSP, you know, tax-free, you know, RIF accounts, and also your holder account. So what type of holder? So it's single holder or joint holder. So you have a total of up to $700,000 per individual per member institution. So if you moved your money around and kept it, you know, with under 100 or 100,000 with each of those accounts, you know, you could have capital in multiple accounts in multiple institutions, and you could have well over $1 million insured in Canada. So wherever people live, I know you have an audience all over the place, so make sure that you understand in your region what your insured values are.
I was going to say, if you had $1 million, do you have to go to 10 different banks to have it insured?
No, that's the beauty. Like, you could have, basically, you know, you could have, you could have some of it in your tax-free saving account. You could have it in an RSP account. You could have it in just a bank account. You could have another one in a checking account. Each individual account is good for $100,000. So she explained that to us. I thought that was great. It was just a really good way to understand it. But you're right. You know, then you might want to say, well, maybe I should have it in a couple different institutions as well.
Now, the U.S. Fed raised rates 25 basis points. Is that going to be the last hike this year?
Well, trying to predict what central banks are going to do is always a bit of a game. You know, I saw a great comment on Twitter the other day, and it said, comment was, Powell to the markets. We're not cutting rates this year. Then markets to Powell, yes, you are. and that's really the way it's been this last year. You know, the markets have been fighting the Fed for the last year. They just, every time, they don't believe the Fed was going to continue to raise rates. So, you know, bonds and yields move opposite. So bonds go up, yields go down, yields go up, bonds go down. And investors buy bonds when they think the rates are going down, and so they want to lock in at that higher rate. So while the Fed sets the short-term rate, the bond market sets the longer-term rate, and that tends to lead the Fed predicting what they think the Fed's going to do. So today, the bond market is betting that the Fed, that the long-term rates are going to decline. Well, the Fed has been raising the short-term rates. So that's resulted in what's called, you know, the inverted yield curve. I know we've talked about that a lot, but people need to understand all this. So the yield curve's inverted, and that's always been a very reliable predictor of a recession. So we've got the bond market calling for a recession and betting that the Fed will soon have to stop raising rates. Now, counter to what the bond market sees, we know that both the Fed and the Bank of Canada say they want real rates to be positive, meaning they want the central bank rate higher than the inflation rate. So if we look at the U.S., their central bank rate is 5%, inflation is 5.9, so their real rate is negative 0.9. Canada, central bank is 4.5, inflation is 5.2, so real rate in Canada is 0.70. So for both these central banks, they are getting closer and closer to their goal of having the real rate equal or even a little above the inflation rate. So I can see that both central banks, I can see them pause. I mean, Canada already paused on their last one. But I can see them pausing and waiting to see the lagging effects of all of their tightening. Plus, you know, if we have any more bank failures, then we're going to have to see more pressure to pause or even cut. Now, you know, I mean, central banks are in a really tough spot here. You know, if they pause and inflation rises, then they're going to have real trouble getting inflation under control. But if they keep raising rates, then they're going to be likely driving the economy deeper into a recession. Plus, of course, if they raise rates, you know, they risk really hurting the already, you know, pretty rocky banking system right now. So, you know, the Fed has said they want to raise rates one more time and then probably pause. I think that's what they want to do. I think over these next few weeks, you know, if we don't have any more banking issues, which I think we're going to have, maybe they'll raise the rates again, but I don't think so. I think they're going to pause and really, you know, give it some breathing room here and see where we go.
In the trend letter, you've been warning about a potential sovereign debt crisis. What is that, and why do you see that?
Well, the reason we need to be concerned is that every major country has borrowed much more money than they could ever pay back. I mean, the global bond market is huge. It's $127 trillion. So that's borrowed money. So, you know, a sovereign debt crisis happens when investors lose confidence in government, and then they no longer want or willing to buy government bonds. You know, there's a big difference between public debt, so government bonds, and private debt, which is corporate bonds. You know, when a company defaults, their assets get sold off, and then the bondholders get some portion of their investment back. But when a government defaults, they have no assets. So, I mean, all they do is they just borrow money. They just borrow money and people buy it because they trust the government will be there in 5 years or 10 years. So they have no assets to sell, so the bondholders get nothing back. And the real risk here is that once one country defaults, panic spreads. And the panic will spread quickly. And then investors in other countries, they start to look around and go, who's next? So, you know, when those next investors, so they start selling off their government bonds, and on it goes. And you know, it's just like we've seen over the last couple of weeks, it's just like a run on the banks. People start to panic, and they start selling off their government bonds. So governments everywhere need to issue bonds in order to pay off their massive debts and deficits. So when there are no buyers for their bonds, governments can't pay their debts. The other thing that we really need to watch here, which I think is really interesting, is that the very real possibility of a world war. As investors, we need to really understand that historically, a world war gives governments the excuse to default on debt. And the way these so-called leaders are talking right now, a world war seems more likely than any time in my life. So for the last year, we've been warning our subscribers to get out of long-term government bonds. You know, short-term bonds are fine. You know, geez, you know, a couple of weeks ago, we were thumping the table to buy them. You know, they were paying 5% for a one-year bond. Nothing wrong with that. But do not buy long-term bonds.
What are your current thoughts regarding the potential for a recession?
Well, you know, with these bank failures, you know, regardless if we see another failure or not, banks are going to have to slow down their lending and tighten requirements, which will certainly add to the economic slowdown. You know, we also have, you know, I think we talked about on your show, Jim, a few times, you know, there's leading indicators that we follow. These aren't lagging indicators. These are leading. And they're pointing to a recession. So since 1955, so we're talking 68 years, there's been only one time when the yield curve inverted, without there being a recession. And today, the yield curve is the most inverted it's been in over 40 years. Also, there's been zero times when inflation ran over 5% with an inverted yield curve that did not result in a recession. Well, you know, inflation's over 5% and we have an inverted yield curve. So, you know, so far it's been 100% that we'll have a recession. So we also have, the Conference Board leading economic indicator, and it has a remarkable history of accurately predicting recessions. Guess what? It's forecasting a recession. So I'm not going to argue with any of that. To me, we're probably going to have a recession, but hopefully it's not a hard landing where things get really nasty. But as investors, we need to understand that if a recession is coming, stock markets do not perform well in recessions.
What do you see ahead for the stock markets?
Well, you know, if you just look back over the last week and a half and just watch the way the market jumped all over the place, stock markets hate uncertainty. And certainly with the banking failures we've seen, markets, they're on edge here. Like every announcement, every word out of the Fed or every word that a bank's having a trouble, you know, markets, they're nervous right now. You know, on Wednesday, just as the market started to calm down with comments where the Treasury officials were saying that they're looking to insure all deposits, you know, the market thought, oh, good. So the market's calmed down. Then Janet Yellen pipes up and says, no, we're not looking at doing that. And all of a sudden the market sold off. You know, so that's where we're sitting here. So 15 years ago, Bear Stearns collapsed and then they were bailed out and then the markets calmed down. But then just a few months later, Lehman Brothers collapsed and there was no bailout. And then that was the start of the financial crisis. So we need to have a bit more time here to ensure that we don't see another shoe drop in the banking sector. And again, I think we're going to see one. So looking beyond the banking crisis, so that's one issue we got to be worried about. But there's a growing list of troubling geopolitical issues that we need to keep our eye on. You know, one big one, of course, is the Russian-Ukraine war. And, you know, it's certainly looking like things are escalating. I mean, the global, you know, we're seeing a huge split here now. We've got the West versus, you know, China and Russia. You know, then, of course, we've got China and Taiwan. We've got North Korea. We've got the Middle East. And then, we got to add in the potential for a recession. So if we get an escalation of any of those, it's not going to be good for the stock market. So, you know, as investors, we just need to be aware of all this stuff. Like, I'm not saying the war is going to kick off, you know, we're going to have a world war tomorrow. But, you know, you start having to think, okay, these things are potentially possible. Maybe we got some short runs here. We can rally, we can play. But you start to have some defensive thoughts in your mind. So one thing to really remember, though, is markets discount problems really quickly. So if we look back to the financial crisis in 2008, you know, we saw some really painful declines in the markets, but soon they overshot to the downside and then they recover really quickly. And that's what I think we're going to see over the next few months and even a couple of years. So right now, our models are looking that we're probably going to see a key, you know, potential key turning point in many markets somewhere in the next, you know, 3 weeks, month. So somewhere middle of April, I think we're going to see something where things are really going to turn. So if the stock market is really low at that point, maybe we have some more banking crisis and, you know, the market really took a beating, you know, somewhere around mid-April, we could see a point where that might be a great buying opportunity. So that's just, you know, things we need to be aware of. So all of our services right now, we've got a bunch of, you know, watch lists that we're looking at. So each one would be sending out buy alerts when we see the next low. So we're going to be looking to play some of these rallies that we're expecting, but we also need to be ready for some sharp pullbacks. So, Jim, for your listeners, you know, I just want one message is be sure to have hedging strategies. You know, they're just like you buy insurance for your house, you buy fire insurance. You need to have some strategies so that you've got some insurance to protect your portfolio. And if you don't understand how to hedge, and it's not hard to do, but our technical trading service offers, you know, many great hedging opportunities. They're very simple to use. But they don't just protect you from a severe market decline. They can actually make you some sizable gains from a big decline. You know, during these last, you know, big drawdown in the markets, you know, a technical trader had some, you know, great, you know, they had different trades, you know, over 300% in 12 weeks, over 200% in 10 weeks. So everybody have some hedging strategies to protect yourself.
What are your thoughts on inflation?
Well, I think inflation is going to be stickier than, you know, most people would hope. you know, it's still double what the Fed's target of 2% is. And, I, you know, realistically, I just don't see 2% ever, you know, not ever, but being realistic for quite a while. You know, the UK just announced on Wednesday what their inflation in February is 10.4%, and that's above their January level of 10. You know, Canada, our rate dropped from 5.9 down to 5.2. U.S. dropped down from 6.2 to 5.9. So, but we need to remember that while we're seeing inflation rates decline year over year, well, that's because a year ago, we started to see those massive rises in inflation. And remember, those were due to the pandemic supply chain shutdown, you know, all those government pandemic relief programs. You know, those are massively inflationary. And then, of course, we had the Ukraine war. So all those things contributed to the rising inflation. So the current inflation is on top of the previous years, so that's compounding. So that just makes it all worse. You know, you look at food prices, they're still very high. I just saw a thing, Canada, you know, prices for food purchased in stores up 10.6% compared to last year. That's the seventh consecutive double-digit increase. So, you know, inflation is coming down in certain areas, but, you know, a lot of the areas that, you know, really hit people hard, especially the lower and middle class, you know, food, you can't go without food. Now, another factor that we need to keep an eye on here is wage inflation. You know, I just, you know, you see these Canada Revenue Agency Employees Union, they're asking for a 31% raise over 3 years. The Public Service Alliance Union, so that's another federal worker union, they're asking for 47% raise over 3 years. You know, big wage demands, you know, big wage increases, they would certainly keep inflation higher than the central banks are wanting. So inflation is going to drop, though, because, you know, so much of it, like I said before, is due to the pandemic lockdowns, which shut down the supply chain, and those massive government pandemic relief programs, and then the war in Ukraine. So of those three, only the war is still a major factor. So inflation should come down. But again, you know, we've got to remember that the labor market is still very tight. So wage demands are still going to be high. And that's still going to kind of put upward pressure on part of the inflation level there.
Gold has done well. And where do you see it going from here?
It has. You know, we've been very bullish gold since back in November. You know, obviously gold right now is having a terrific run as a safe haven play to all the fears caused by the bank run. Back in November, we actually showed subscribers a chart of gold versus the S&P 500 and really noted that gold was starting to trend higher. And that's a really key bullish thing that we watch for. So in the last couple of weeks, you know, that trend has obviously accelerated due to the banking concerns. But, you know, we saw the same story when we compared gold to the commodity index. So we think that these trends are going to continue over the next few years. You know, one of the big drivers for gold going forward is going to be loss of confidence investors have in government. You know, investors, I mean, we've seen it right now. You know, gold's going up. Why is it going up? People are seeing, you know, all these crazy things going on with the banks. You know, who's running the economy? So people are going to gold. So, you know, events just like that banking crisis, it really feeds into that theme. So people are starting to really question the competency of politicians and especially the bureaucrats that are running these different, you know, these different agencies. So one of the, once the confidence is broken, we expect that we're going to see gold rise along with the U.S. dollar as safe haven plays. So we're buyers of gold and silver on pullbacks. You know, gold is technically overbought here. So if the banking crisis does calm down, we should see a pullback, which should give us another really good buying opportunity.
What do you see ahead for energy?
We like energy. I see oil was down today here on Friday. But, you know, with oil for the last few months, we've been telling our subscribers to hold off buying any oil or oil stocks because our models were showing that oil is going to drop under $70 and our target was the low to mid 60s. Well, we hit, you know, just under $66 last week. So that triggered some buy signals for us. So we issued six new energy stocks. So we're quite bullish on energy. On the demand side for oil, you know, we got China starting up, and I think that's going to be huge. Now, on the supply side, you know, we've got the same old story. We've got governments imposing these windfall taxes, tight regulations, no new drilling permits. You know, those are all major disincentives for producers. Capital expenditures in the oil sector, I mean, they're down 30, 35-year lows. So that lack of investment in the sector is going to cause serious supply problems long term. You know, I'm all for green energy, but you know, we need to be realistic on the time frame here, and we're going to need fossil fuels for much longer than these governments are projecting. So longer term, we see oil having a really strong next few years. Certainly we're going to see $100 oil. And I'm looking, we're going to hit 150 or higher in the next few years. And now, if we do have a recession, which, you know, I think we're going to, that would likely hit demand, and that would push lower, you know, prices lower. But again, if that happens, it presents another great buying opportunity. So we're rating our first, our initial buy target, you know, rating our buy signals. So and we started to add, six new energy trades. We've got a bunch more on our watch list, so we'll see how that goes. Gasoline, based on seasonality, we typically see a really strong rally starting from right about now into June. Natural gas, the trends, that tends to be very volatile and certainly weather dependent. You know, we've had a much warmer winter this year, so that's crushed the prices. I mean, you know, we had all of the war stuff in Europe and all that, which drove, natural gas prices, they were $9.50 in August. Today it's $2.20. So again, typically natural gas starts to rise, early March to June. So far we haven't seen that seasonal rise. And as I said, natural gas tends to be very volatile. I mean, if we look just in the last year and a bit, we saw spikes in natural gas of 30% in less than a month, 32% in 7 weeks, 81% in 6 weeks, 165% in over 5 months. Natural gas is $2.20 today. I mean, if it gets just even to $3.50, that would be a 50% plus increase. So we'd take it.
What are your thoughts on the U.S. dollar?
Well, U.S. dollar's had some wild swings here in the last couple of weeks, with the banking crisis unfolding. U.S. dollar is a safe haven play. So, as things started to unravel, the U.S. dollar rallied and then it dropped because, the markets go, oh, the Fed's going to start pausing, and then we've got ECB raising rates. So if the euro's, if the ECB raises rates, that's good for the euro. If the Fed pauses, that's not good for the dollar. So that's all jumping around. I think if we see another banking thing, depending where it is, if it's in Europe, well, the dollar's going to rally. So right now, the U.S. dollar's trading at 102. So that's here on Friday. So that's exactly basically its long-term support level. So that needs to hold. So it needs to hold. And then what we would like to see is it hold above $1.05. And that should form a base there. And if it can form a base there, we'd see, resistance at that 105 and then push to 108, 110. But again, I think if we can see the U.S. dollar hold around here, if it starts to rise, that indicates that there's some other trouble happening.
Where are you looking to invest now and over the next year or so?
There's a lot of things we like. So we just mentioned energy. So we like, oil, gas, or gasoline, natural gas. We like nuclear, so uranium, precious metals, gold and silver, rare earths, critical metals for the green initiatives. I mean, we've got governments falling all over themselves offering subsidies for exploration and production of critical metals. It's interesting. They finally seem to realize we actually need this stuff if we're going to, if we're going to make everybody drive an electric vehicle. We're going to need some batteries, and we're going to need a lot of charging stations and all of that stuff. If we want a lot of windmills, well, we need materials to go into that. So I'm sure that this is going to surprise a lot of people, but to us, the least critical metal right now is lithium. It's a very common element And plus, with all of these governments handing out money left, right, and center to build lithium mines, we see that we're seeing that there's going to be an oversupply. Lithium prices are already down over 50% since November, and we expect that price is going to fall further as these new supplies come on stream. Now, on the other hand, we see copper as one of the most critical metals for the green initiative. So copper is difficult to find, so we see that prices are going to remain pretty solid. Aluminum is another key that we like. Very key for a high voltage electricity transmission. Other sectors, we like tech, which is going to do very well once we see these rates come down and once we get through what we expect to see a recession. For stocks, we expect to see a lot of volatility here. That's going to result in some really solid rallies, but also some deep pullbacks. So we need to be careful, really watch, again, hedging strategies as we move through the rest of this year and next year. With bonds, we expect to see a flight to safety if we see another shoe drop in the banking sector. And again, Jim, your investors really need to understand that we're going to see a very volatile year again in the markets. And, that's why we're here. That's what we do. We're there to help our subscribers navigate through all these various gyrations. So these can be stressful times, but they can also be great opportunity.
Can you tell us a little bit again about your special offer?
Yeah. So basically, we have three services, and then you can mix and match and package them up if you like. So they can get 40% off from any single service, and then up to 65% off if you package different things together. So they can just go to get those special orders, go to the trendletter. So all one word, thetrendletter.com/special-offer. Now, also, your listeners can sign up for our free, so it's free, daily headline service. So that's where we review what's going on in the markets every morning. And then we send out headlines that we think investors should be aware of. So that goes out every morning. And, it's got all the headlines. You can just read the headlines. And if you want to read about that story, just click on the link and read the whole story. And, again, our promise is there's no spam. You sign up for our free stuff. You don't get constantly, spammed. Get all these emails sent to you, all these different services being offered. We don't do that. So if any of your listeners have any questions about our services or just, what we talked about today or anything that they see on our site, just email us at info@thetrendletter.com.
Martin, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
My pleasure, Jim. Have a great weekend.
My guest has been Martin Straith, founder of Trend News, online at thetrendletter.com. And that wraps up our show for this week. We'd like to thank our guests, Ross Clark, John Rubino, and Martin Straith, and thank you for listening. If you have any comments for the show or questions for our guests, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. Now stand by for a company showcase update from Zarko Maselgia, the CEO of Recyclico. I'm Jim Goddard. We'll be back next week with more This Week in Money.
Comments made on This Week in Money are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. This Week in Money is a production of How Street Media Incorporated. Executive producer is Tom Allen. Welcome to Company Showcase, an advertising feature on HowStreet.com.
I'm Jim Goddard. My guest is Zarko Maselgia. He's the Chief Executive Officer of Recyclico. Zarko, you've been a very busy guy traveling to how many conferences in the past little while?
Yeah, well, thank you, Jim. I know it's been a few busy weeks. It's been especially our week in Korea. Mm. I was there with our CFO, Shaheem Ali, and the Vice President of Cometco, Joey Jung. And it was a good team to have with me to attend a number of meetings. that, you know, included a variety of technical, finance, and business questions. But during the week that we were there, it was also the InterBattery Conference, which is one of the biggest battery conferences in the world, and rightfully so given Korea's maturity in the battery industry. I was expecting to spend more time there, but could only squeeze in a few hours between our meetings. From what I did see, I was very impressed with the latest innovations in battery technology and the business plans for many emerging companies. And the plan is not just for the Korean market, because with the significant incentives announced by the IRA, it seems like every month there's an investment in a new battery plant in North America. You know, even today, LG Energy Solutions announced plans to build a battery manufacturing complex in Arizona, which they say would be the largest single investment ever for a standalone battery manufacturing facility in North America. And only a few months ago, you know, LG Chem announced plans to build a cathode manufacturing facility in Tennessee, which would be the largest in the U.S. But from the other side of the other ocean, I was also very happy to read that Volkswagen chose Canada to build its first battery plant outside of Europe. It really shows how powerful the IRA incentives are to give Volkswagen an incentive to prioritize those investment decisions in North America. And their investment also joins other investments in building that EV battery supply chain in Canada, you know, such as before we heard Stellantis, LG Energy Solutions, and BASF. Although these announcements will be some of the largest battery projects, they, you know, just keep in mind they're not producing batteries or scrap now, but it does give context to the total addressable recycling market of the future and the potential of our integrated business model, which really looks to be at the source where these waste materials will be produced, which would be battery plants, EV plants, cathode plants. But recycling is also going to play a big part in the IRA incentives, and the need for battery recycling will definitely be, you know, will be a certainty. We'll need to recycle these materials. So, you know, I think big opportunities still to come for the industry. But coming back to our Korea trips, it wasn't just all boardroom meetings. You know, we also had the opportunity to take a few site tours outside of Seoul. Personally, I always like seeing the real work that's happening to really just get a sense of scale and the real day-to-day work. You know, one of those visits was to Sonet, who we signed an MOU with earlier this year when they visited us in Vancouver. And since the signing of the MOU, both sides continued their due diligence, and our visit was a good opportunity to learn more from them in detailed in-person discussions and take that back with us to review with our internal team. But both the technical and business due diligence is part of the process in our MOU, but I'm glad to see their knowledge in the Korean market and their excitement for battery recycling really shows. This week as well, I was supposed to be in Orlando. Unfortunately, I got caught with a stomach bug or whatever was going around, and luckily Shaheem was able to take my place for the presentation. And you know, he's kept me informed, and seems like there's a lot of positive meetings and introductions that happened during the event. And kind of look forward to getting in touch with some of those people at a future event as well in the future. But yeah, Jim, as always, happy to provide listeners with the company update on these podcasts, and just wanted to advise those following company news that the most accurate source for any material change information regarding the company would come directly from Recyclico.
Sarko, your company has a unique patented process that doesn't recover part of what's in an EV battery. You recover it all, don't you?
Well, you know, we focus on the cathode material, and we have very high extraction rates, able to recover lithium, nickel, manganese, and cobalt within the cathode material of the lithium-ion battery. And, you know, it's not just so much, like you said, recovering it, but it's upcycling that material so So not just recovering the individual cobalt or nickel, but upcycling it into the high value, you know, battery ready precursor materials and high purity lithium hydroxide that can go back into new battery manufacturing.
And Zarco, you have a demonstration plant already working on all those concepts, right?
Yeah, that's our, you know, scaled up facility. Just like the name says, the demonstration plant is to demonstrate real world scaled up conditions. And then that really helps us collect engineering data, design for future commercial operations, where with our integrated business model, we will look to form multiple joint ventures with companies. And that demonstration plant is, you know, a really key step in accelerating those plans, you know, and bringing visitors in to see the operation, being able to test materials that are coming through and produce products to also be analyzed, like we've done in the past, where we've had battery cells be made from our material and validated for its electrochemical performance. This all really steps in bringing all these pieces together. That demonstration plant is really a key component to all that.
Zarco, for people who need to get more information about the company and find out where you're traded, where do they go?
You can visit our website, www.recyclico.com, and there we'll also have, you know, all of our press releases and announcements. You can also sign up to our mailing list. We are traded on the TSXV under AMY, on the OTCQB under AMYZF, and the Frankfurt Stock Exchange under ID4.
Zarco, thank you so much for the update.
Thanks, Jim.
My guest has been Zarco Masalgia, Chief Executive Officer of Recyclico. I'm Jim Goddard. Our conversation took place on March 24th.
Comments made on Company Showcase are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at HowStreet.com. Company Showcase is a production of How Street Media Incorporated.